just when you think she's out of your life, she pops back up. It's like shingles.
Or worse, the Clintons.
I just can't get rid of those people.
But they have an ointment for shingles. What are you gonna do? Some kind of a spray for the Clintons. What's that smell? It's the Clintons.
Hello and welcome into this edition of the Daily Perspective Podcast. Mark Congleton, your sometimes humble host here. Hoping you're having a great day. We're going to have about an hour of observation, insight, and absurdity here, and I hope you'll hang around and enjoy the fun. It is the Thursday, August 20th, 2020 edition of the Daily Perspective Podcast. I've been out of pocket for a couple of days. I had an early session, outside session yesterday morning and couldn't be here. And then Tuesday, can I just be honest with you for a minute here? I just needed the day Tuesday. It's kind of medical in nature. I'm not going to get into personal stuff, but I needed a day of recovery from something. And it just, it's an intermittent issue that hits me from time to time. And the only solution is to just stop everything and to rest a bit. And so rest I did on Tuesday and as much as possible yesterday. And I'm feeling probably about 80% better, doing better. Everything is looking good. There will come a point at some time later in the day when if I sit down, I will go to sleep. I know how this works. It just sucks everything out of me and boom, I'm gone. So I'm stacking things up to keep me busy today. And at some point, even though at some point I'll say, wow, I need to go take a break, and I will take a break, and then the nap monster will catch up with me. But such is life. I would rather be there doing that in facing that than watching the Democrats doing their convention thing, because it's like watching the Titanic sink. It's painful. It's horrible. It's ridiculously preventable, and yet it goes forward. And everybody is talking about what everybody is saying at the convention, and I really, really, really don't want to do that today. I'm looking at my list of things to talk about, and I have, let's see, there is one, there's one story. I think there may be just a total of one directly linked story in my stack of things to talk about today that is directly linked, I should say, to the Democrat convention. And we'll get to that and get it out of the way as quickly as possible in just a few minutes and hopefully not talk anymore about what's going on there. And I'm not one of these people, to be honest with you, I'm not one of these people who can watch and enjoy a parade of people lying to the American public. I can't watch it and point and laugh. I just can't, because it is so deeply disturbing to me that I will opt to watch almost anything else on television instead. And it looks like America, by and large, feels the same way. Viewership of the Democrat convention is down 50% from where it was 4 years ago. 50% down. Half the number of people are watching it. I think people are sick of it. We're beginning to see polls telling us that independents are swinging to the right. We're seeing Democrats changing their minds, shaking their heads, and walking away because they see the insanity of what's happening in the Democrat Party. The Democrat Party is becoming the Marxist Party. They can call themselves Democratic Socialists. They can call themselves Progressives. They can call themselves anything. You can call yourself a cucumber. You're still a person. And the Democrats can call themselves whatever they want. They're still Marxists. And they are trying to push Marxism on America by lying to America. And sadly, I see people, and some are my friends, some members are family, some are members of family, I should say, and I see them buying into what they're being told by CNN, MSNBC, the prime time news on the networks. I see them buying into all of this stuff. And then when they go to look and research what they're being told, they look to more sources who are pushing the same viewpoints instead of searching out opposing viewpoints and comparing the two and digging into the trails on to the roots of both of them to find out what really is real, which is what you have to do. So we have a nation of uninformed people, the court of public opinion, which is being fed a lot of garbage, and they're going to make a decision based on the garbage being fed to them. And I have a little bit of hope here. Actually, it's more than a little bit. I think a lot of people are getting fed up with being fed fertilizer, and they've decided to shake it off and go lean another direction. I hope that happens. It's happened in Florida. If I may go ahead and dive into the first story I have in my stack, former Broward County Sheriff Scott Israel lost a primary bid. He was hoping to reclaim his office yesterday after Governor Ron DeSantis suspended him in January of last year. Broward Sheriff Gregory Tony declared victory in the Democratic contest, edging out Israel by about 4,000 votes in the six-candidate primary. DeSantis appointed Tony to head the sheriff's office after suspending Israel over failures related to the February 2018 mass shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. We all remember that. Tony said in a statement, "I'm deeply honored. The Democratic voters have chosen me to lead the Broward Sheriff's Office to a brighter, safer future. We've come a long way in the last 18 months, but there's still much work to be done. Together, we're reforming the Sheriff's Office, promoting good deputies, and keeping our communities safer by embracing police reform. As your sheriff, I work tirelessly to make this department a model for how a public safety agency can be effective, transparent, and accountable to our community. Let's keep moving forward." Now, Tony is expected to win in the November election over the Republican candidate Wayne Clark and independent Charles Whatley. It's a heavily Democratic district. Israel did concede the race in an interview with WSVN. He said, "The people have spoken, and I accept the decision of the voter. I want the community to know that I poured my heart and soul into being the sheriff of Broward County, and I fought hard to protect everyone's rights." Everyone? Apparently not everyone, because there were people at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School who are no longer with us because of this man's, quote, leadership, end quote. Andrew Pollack, who lost a daughter in that 2018 shooting, tweeted, "Scott Israel's failures led to the death of my daughter. He bragged about his amazing leadership. He mocked my family and our fight for justice for years. But tonight, righteousness won over the wicked." And I say, well, good for Broward County. It's still a heavily Democratic district, but good for them anyway, for picking the obvious right choice, or making the obvious right decision in not putting this man back in charge again. Now, the Broward County Sheriff's Office is the largest sheriff's office in Florida. They've been mired in controversy stemming from Israel's handling of the Parkland shooting. It resulted in the deaths of 17 people, injuries to 17 others. Israel's been accused of contributing to the death toll by changing department policy to say deputies may, instead of shall, confront active shooters. That may change gave deputies the out not to enter, said Polk County Sheriff Grady Judd. He's a member of the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School Public Safety Commission. He said this in December of 2018. He went on to say they decided to be cowards instead of heroes. In April of 2018, hundreds of Israel's own deputies turned on him as the Broward Sheriff's Office Deputies Association held a no-confidence vote that went overwhelmingly against him, 534-94, the first time the union had voted no confidence in a sheriff. The union president, Jeff Bell, said after that vote, "Israel fails to listen to the people. He fails to listen to the membership, and he wants to blame everybody else for his problems." End quote. And you know what that says? What that means? Can I translate for you? Scott Israel is a to the bone progressive. He doesn't listen to the people around him. He doesn't listen to the membership of his organization. And when he fails, he wants to blame everybody else. He is a progressive through and through. And his progressive leadership cost 17 lives, injuries to 17 others. And he refused to assume responsibility for it. A leader assumes responsibility. A leader will say, hey, it stops with me. I will deal with the problems. I will assume the responsibility. A leader does that. A progressive doesn't. If you look at what's happening right now in this election, if you saw what happened last night, and I'm sorry, but I have to talk about the convention. You saw, actually, if you've been watching it, period, at all, you've seen person after person stand in front of a camera and deny reality. You've seen candidate after candidate, politician after politician, denying what's actually happening in America and denying what happened in 2016. We watched Hillary Clinton talk about how she said, you can win by 3 million votes and still lose an election. So we've got to overwhelmingly vote for Joe Biden. Paraphrase. She's still in denial. What happened to Hillary Clinton was that she campaigned for the popular vote. She campaigned and played a system that she believed had been properly rigged so that there was no way she could lose. On the flip side of the coin, Donald Trump looked at the way our system actually operates, and he campaigned that way. He campaigned to win the Electoral College, and he succeeded. Hillary Clinton thought it was a lock. So did Barack Obama. So did everybody, including the pundits on all the news channels. They went into the evening of election night talking about how it was going to be historic to have a woman president, because there was no chance that Trump could win. And as the night passed, it became obvious that everything they had been fed, everything they chose to believe, was a lie. And the man everybody was laughing at and said had no chance defeated the person who had every chance. And we've been watching night after night at a virtual convention that 50% of the last convention's audience has decided not to watch. We've been watching politician after politician, entertainer after entertainer, step up and ignore reality and blame their losses on something besides their failures. This is typical of progressivism. It continues today. It will always continue. It is how progressives operate. They convince you that they are the experts. They convince you that they are the intellectual and moral elite. They convince you that they have the answers. They convince you that they want a fairer, more equitable country. They want a place where everybody can thrive. And when they fail because their principles and their plans don't work in the real world, they blame everyone else but themselves. Everyone but themselves. And we've been watching that happen for the past few days as the Democrats have their virtual convention. There will be a stark contrast next week from all of the negativity that we've been watching with the Democrats and all of the finger pointing and blame there will be a stark contrast next week when the Republicans take the stage. I'm looking forward to that. Although, still, it's going to be tough for me to watch because I just don't like watching politicians talk. Oh, man. We'll deal with just a little bit more of that after the break. That is when this Thursday edition of the Daily Perspective Podcast continues. Welcome back. It's the Daily Perspective Podcast for Thursday, the 20th day of August, 2020. Thanks a lot for listening. Thanks for being here. I appreciate you joining in for the fun every day. Well, most every day. Yeah, I already explained why I wasn't here the last couple of days, but try to be here most days, if at all possible. And if not, you know, I try to let you know exactly why. Let's see, where were we? Well, we were talking about the convention, and we were talking about, I wanted to talk about Obama. Hang on, I have to move a couple of tabs on my browser around here. Okay, now, former President Barack Obama criticized President Donald Trump during his Wednesday address at the Democratic National Convention, saying Trump has no interest in living up to the expectations of American citizens. He came as the next-to-last address of the DNC's third night, just before Democratic California Senator Kamala Harris. Obama argued that Trump has failed to lead the United States amid the coronavirus, has threatened the right to vote ahead of the November election, and has failed to live up to the decency of the office of president. I have to stop here and remind you that the Obamas talk about going high. When they go low, we go high. And what happens is that they speak out of both sides of their mouth. They talk about being principled and being decent, the decency of the office of the president. And yet, they wrap everything in this comfortable politicism. Is that a word? In this politispeak that people are comfortable in hearing in certain styles and methods. And it sounds presidential, but the whole time they're doing exactly what they're condemning. He says Trump failed to lead the U.S. amid the coronavirus. Well, let me remind you that while the Democrats were playing politics with an attempt to impeach President Trump, they were wrapped up in courting the news media. They were wrapped up in parading before the cameras. They were all wrapped up in this dog and pony show trying to impeach President Trump. President Trump was warning America, there's an infection, there's a disease, there's a virus that's coming out of China, and we need to protect America. And he began to take measures to do so, preventing flights from China, etc. And while he tried to do that, not only were they trying to impeach him, they were ridiculing him and accusing him of being racist for shutting down travel from where the virus originated. Remember, he actually did take the lead on the coronavirus and maintained the lead on coronavirus from then forward until today. Even still today, he's leading on the coronavirus. And all they've done is criticize and condemn. They haven't led on anything. All they've done is throw hand grenades at the man as he's tried to work. He says that Trump has threatened the right to vote ahead of the November election. He has done no such thing. None. No such thing. That's completely and totally manufactured out of thin air. And then, of course, he's failed to live up to the decency of the office of the president. He went on to say, Donald Trump hasn't grown into the job because he can't. This administration has shown it will tear our democracy down if that's what it takes to win, so we've got to get busy. I would like to remind former President Obama that the United States of America is not a democracy. The United States of America is a representative constitutional republic. It is not a democracy. You see, progressives continually call the United States a democracy in order to change the terminology, in order to change the phrasing so that people will just use that term. Oh, well, we live in a great democracy. No, we live in a great republic. We live in a representative republic, a constitutionally founded representative republic, not a democracy. Democracies always eat themselves. They destroy themselves. And so our founders created a republic. And those who want a democracy ever since have been trying to transform it into a democracy. Some seeking to fundamentally
transforming the United States of America
into a democracy. Obama's speech also leaned into a larger message from the DNC's night, urging Americans to vote early by mail if possible, as well as to vote in person. He urged Americans who may be feeling disaffected with the political system to trust it and remember the sacrifices made by earlier civil rights activists under far worse circumstances. You see, the Democrats know that people are disgusted by what's going on in politics right now. They know they are, and they're trying to blame it on Trump. When Trump has actually come in, and rather than following the pattern that we're all comfortable with, has just been real. He's just said what's on his mind, instead of couching things in political terms and trying not to hurt people's feelings. He's just said what he thought. And he said what he thought during the speech last night by Obama. On Twitter, President Trump tweeted, "He spied on my campaign and got caught," reminding America that the man speaking to America at the Democrat convention is a non-convicted criminal. He also pointed to Obama's seeming reluctance to endorse Biden. He said, "Why did he refuse to endorse Slow Joe until it was all over? And even then it was very late. Why did he try to get him not to run?" Good questions. I've said recently, in part, that's kind of obvious. You don't want to, when you've got a religious following like Obama has, you don't want to throw your endorsement behind somebody until it's absolutely certain. Because Obama's protecting his image and his legacy. If he throws his endorsement behind Joe Biden and Joe Biden somehow manages to, if I can use Obama's terminology, F things up. Remember, Obama did say, don't underestimate Joe Biden's ability to F things up. Actually, he said never underestimate that ability. So if Joe F's things up, and isn't the nomination, it doesn't get the nomination, then Obama has endorsed a loser. That's why he didn't. But still, he did try to get him not to run, and he did say, never underestimate Joe's ability. Remember? And he, by the way, is not alone. I posted to social media yesterday a story about that. And I'm hoping that you'll go back and look at that. I was looking at, hang on here. Oh, I just found it. I found a story and I posted it to social media early this morning. It's from Politico and it is under the convention's 2020 banner. It says the president was not encouraging what Obama really thought about Biden. Let me share as much of this as I can with you. It goes on for a little bit, but I want you to hear some of the things that are in it. The way Joe Biden explained it on the campaign trail in Iowa, he and his friend Barack Obama had long talked of Biden succeeding him in the White House, continuing the work of their administration. It was only tragic fate in the form of the loss of his son, Beau, that intervened. Now, after 4 years, the plan could finally go forward, but with Biden running as the administration's true heir. Barack Obama, Biden solemnly declared in his campaign announcement in Philadelphia, is an extraordinary man, an extraordinary president. On the social media generated Best Friends Day, the campaign posted a picture of Joe and Barack friendship bracelets. Biden relabeled himself an Obama Biden Democrat. But behind all the BFF bonhomie is a much more complicated story, one fueled by the misgivings the 44th president had about the would-be 46th. The deep hurt still felt about Biden's allies, over how Obama embraced Hillary Clinton as a successor, and a powerful sense of pride that's driving Biden to prove that the former president and many of his aides underestimated the very real strengths of his partner. So there is an undergirding tension in all of this. There's more, and I'll get to it. I love this. Jen Psaki, the former White House communications director, said, "You could certainly see technocratic eye rolling at times." Young White House aides frequently mocked Biden's gaffes and lacks of discipline in comparison to the almost clerical Obama. They would chortle at how Biden, like an elderly uncle at Thanksgiving, would launch into extended monologues that everyone had heard before. You see, nobody in the White House really respected Joe. And most of them don't now. It's the Daily Perspective Podcast. Good to have you in. The 20th day of August, 2020. I was talking about this situation with Biden and Obama. During the Obama administration, heaven help us if there is a Biden administration. And just a couple of more things. This article from Politico, I've put the link in today's show notes. So get the show notes to get the entire article. But I want to pass some of it along to you because it's interesting to see what's been written here about Joe Biden and how he was even then, back before his current diminished capacity. And no, I'm not being cruel. Let's just say you go back 5 years and look at video of 5 years ago of Joe Biden and how he handled crowds, how he managed things, how he worked in Congress and the like, and then compare that with what you're watching now, and you will see there is a definite diminished capacity issue here. He is just not what he used to be. He's just not as sharp. He's not as quick. He's not as there. In fact, a former White House physician has said, Joe just looks lost. And that's what I'm referring to. But even during those years, things were odd in the White House. Real quickly, just a little bit more here. Ben Rhodes, Obama's former deputy national security advisor, who was known for his mind meld with the president, wrote in his memoir that, quote, in the Situation Room, Biden could be something of an unguided missile, end quote. Former FBI Director James Comey recalled in his book that, quote, Obama would have a series of exchanges heading a conversation very clearly and crisply in direction A. Then at some point, Biden would jump in with, can I ask something, Mr. President? Obama would politely agree, but something in his expression suggested he knew full well that for the next 5 or 10 minutes, we would all be heading in direction Z. After listening and patiently waiting, President Obama would then bring the conversation back on course. Meanwhile, Biden loyalists stewed, aware that the vice president, who had gotten himself elected to the Senate at age 29 in the year of President Richard Nixon's landslide reelection and served 36 years, had a range of Washington political skills Obama lacked. The president and his closest allies seemed unaware of how he would alienate potential allies with his preachy tone, particularly in Congress, where Biden excelled. Biden, for his part, felt Obama too often let his head get in the way. Quote, sometimes I thought he was deliberate to a fault. That's from his 2017 book, Promise Me, Dad. And so they were not, you know, joined at the hip, as Biden would like to have you believe. And not only was Biden a gaffe master in public appearances, he was disconnected in the Situation Room when they were trying to plan things, trying to work things, trying to make things head a certain direction, trying to be a team. Biden was disconnected. Instead of following the path of topic A, he would ask questions about topic Z and then preach on about it and tell stories about it and so forth. And so he's not exactly, even then, all together, not focused on what is actually happening. And that's a sad situation. It truly is a sad situation. And we're facing a sad situation right now. And that is that this guy, who clearly is not who he used to be, is the Democrat choice for president. And that is very, very odd, very strange, very disconcerting. Now, Joe's history is coming back to bite him. Daily Wire has an article about how they met, about how Joe and Jill got together. According to Jill Biden's first husband, Bill Stevenson, the story she and her present husband, Joe Biden, tell about how they met after she divorced Stevenson is not true. Stevenson claims Joe Biden was having an affair with his wife while she was still married to Stevenson. Back in 2008, the New York Times reported on how Joe Biden explained meeting his present wife, Jill. They wrote, Senator Joseph R. Biden Jr. has said he first saw pictures of Jill Jacobs in March of 1975 in an advertisement for a local park in Wilmington, Delaware. The young blonde caught his eye. She was beautiful. You might call her drop-dead gorgeous. That night, his brother Frank told him he had the number of a young woman that the senator would like, mainly because she didn't like politics. Mr. Biden called her the next day and asked her out for that very night. She was busy. Mr. Biden persisted. He was in town for only one night. Couldn't she change her plans? She did, finally, and when Mr. Biden arrived to pick her up, she turned out to be the woman in the advertisement. The Bidens, who've been married since 1977, have publicly said they met on a blind date in 1975, after Joe became a widower and Jill's first marriage had broken up. That's what the New York Post reported. Speaking to the Daily Mail in an exclusive interview from his home in Wilmington, Delaware, Stevenson stated, I don't want to hurt anyone, but facts are facts, and what happened, happened. Stevenson asserted that he first met Jill in August of 1969, saying, I was leaving for Woodstock the following day. I was at a car wash, and she and her friend came over to admire my 1968 Z28 Camaro. It was yellow with black stripes, all the rage at the time. I was going to my friend's birthday party that night, so I invited him along. There were four good-looking girls in that apartment, and I thought the more the merrier. The rest is history. Stevenson, who is the founder of the Stone Balloon, that's a famed live music club that Rolling Stone once called the best-kept secret in rock and roll, he continues that he married Jill Jacobs in 1970, adding, it was February, believe it was the 7th. 2 years later, as Biden ran for the Senate, the Stevensons worked on his campaign. That's what Stevenson's claiming. Biden was still married to his first wife, Nelia, who was tragically killed along with their one-year-old daughter, Naomi, in a car crash before Biden was sworn into Senate. As an aside here, please remember that Biden has for years lied about how they died. He blamed it on a truck driver. He has said the truck driver was drinking. The police reports don't support that. Nothing supports that. In fact, everything supports that Nelia pulled out in front of an oncoming truck. That Nelia was not watching what she was doing. And that as a result, she and their daughter were killed. And that this truck driver was mortified. He tried to help. He tried to rescue. He was working with people trying to get them out of the car. And ever since, Joe Biden has blamed the truck driver and said he was driving drunk. And nothing supports that whatsoever. He has lied about that for all these years. Back to the article. Stevenson says, Jill and I sat in the Biden's kitchen. We worked on his campaign. I gave $10,900 to his first campaign in cash. Stevenson said he first suspected Biden and Jill were having an affair in August of 1974. Remember, they claimed to have met in 1975, a blind date. He was then 26, Jill was 23, Joe was 31. Stevenson said, I know exactly when it was. Bruce Springsteen was going to play at the Stone Balloon, and I had to go to Northern New Jersey to pay him in advance. I asked Jill to go with me, and she said no, she had things to do. She had to look after Joe's kids, Bo and Hutter. It was kind of a big deal to go meet Springsteen. I had no idea she and Joe were that kind of friendly. When one of her best friends told me she thought Joe and Jill were getting a little too close, I was surprised that she came to me. He says that in October of 74, he says, I was at work and a guy came in and asked, do you own a brown Corvette? I said, yeah, that's my wife's car. He said back in May it had crunched his bumper and they told him to get an estimate and he never heard back from them. I said, wait a minute, who is they? And he said, funnily enough, Senator Biden was driving. Stevenson concluded, I asked Jill to leave the house, which she did. Her father was begging me to take her back when he found out what was going on. He asked me to give her a second chance, but I wasn't interested. I considered Joe a friend. I'm not surprised he fell in love with Jill. Everyone who meets Jill falls in love with her immediately. It's hard not to. He goes on to say he has an autobiography in the works. He says it's ready to go. He says he genuinely doesn't want to harm Jill's chances of becoming First Lady. She'd make an excellent First Lady, but this is his story. Yeah, he's got a book. It's election time. He could sell. I mean, he's going to make a lot of sales. He's no doubt taking advantage of the situation to publicize a book. But at the same time, he divorced his wife. And he says it was because she was having an affair with Senator Joe Biden. And all of these years later, they're still lying about how they met. All of these years later. You see, Joe Biden, as I have said many times, and I've reminded you many times, is a compulsive, habitual liar. It's one of the things that makes him a great progressive politician. He's a compulsive liar. He's lied about his education. He's lied about his history. He's lied about the way his wife died. Apparently, he's lying about how he and his current wife met. He's lied about many, many, many things. He's a loose cannon in meetings. You never know what he's going to say. You don't know if he's actually paying attention to what's really going on. What he says may not be pertinent to what's actually happening. And today, when you watch him, because he is in controlled environments, always, you see him on camera, and if you watch his eyes, you see he's reading almost all the time. If you saw the video from the convention the other night when his wife was speaking to the convention, and he steps in at the end, you can see his eyes cutting to his script. He's looking to the right of the camera, the right side of the screen. He's reading. And he ad-libs a couple of times. And when he goes off script, you can visibly see Jill Biden gulp at one point. She maintains her composure, but you can tell that behind the facade, she's thinking, oh my God, are we going to recover from this? Because he left the script. They're controlling everything now, everything they can. He's going to wander off the script because that's Joe. He's the gaff master. The only thing they're succeeding him in keeping him from doing is touching people now because of COVID. It's playing to their advantage. But how long are they going to be able to milk that? Welcome back to the Daily Perspective Podcast for this Thursday, the 20th day of August. Good to have you along. I appreciate you being there and thank you so much for playing along. I'm trying to find something here. I was looking for some audio during the break. And my computer, sometime yesterday, my computer rebooted. And if you have a Mac, you know this thing. Your computer rebooted because of a problem. You know, you go to your computer or you nudge your mouse or something, and this little block comes up. And it reminds you that you've had a problem. So the computer's rebooted. And now when I log into things, it's like it's the first time I've ever logged into things. I logged into an audio program that I use. It's called Farrago, and if you're a Mac user, it's by Rogue Amoeba, I should say, and it's actually a very cool button bar program. If you have a MacBook and you are responsible for like working with your kids' softball or baseball, little league or something like that, and you want to be able to play all of the, you want to be able to play all the sounds and stuff over the PA system, this is an excellent program. It's $20-$30, and you can have page after page after page after page after page of buttons that gives you the ability to play back stuff. And let's see. Let's see. I was going to try to find here one. We'll see if that'll play. And there's another one. And a bike, laser. There's a crowd. It's a big crowd here today. So it's stuff like that. And some of the stuff, you can loop it so that it goes over and over and over and over again. And let me get rid of that. That's annoying. It's anyway, but I pulled it up, and because I have audio of certain politicians, and I have embarrassing audio of them saying stupid things, and James Clyburn was one of them that I had audio of, and I wanted to play it, but all those buttons are gone until I enter all of my information again. Anyway, House Majority Whip Representative Jim Clyburn. Argues that the U.S. Postal Service isn't losing money. He's living in a fantasy world. And he says everything the government is involved with doesn't need to turn a profit. Well, last quarter, the U.S. Postal Service reported a net loss of $2.2 billion. That's a bit down from $2.3 billion the same quarter last year. Clyburn said, he told The Hill, it's not a business, it's a service. And this whole notion that we have to get rid of the post office because it's losing money. The post office isn't losing money. You're paying for a service to keep this country together. Well, nobody's talking about getting rid of the postal service. Nobody's talking about it making a profit. We're talking about it breaking even. We're talking about it not losing $2.2 billion a quarter. We're talking about it not being a hole in our government services that we keep throwing money into. He added, the notion that everything the government does is supposed to make a profit. That's why we have so many students in debt today, because we started making a profit off of student loans. We ought to be assisting students to get an education. So he admits that the government involvement in student debt is the result. The result is that students are deep in debt because the government got involved. Will he eliminate the government involvement? No, he won't, because that control factor has to be there. But he does admit. House Speaker Pelosi is calling the House back into session to provide federal assistance to the Postal Service heading into the November election. Now, she won't come back for COVID aid. And that's why you're not getting another stimulus check right now. She won't come back for that, but she'll come back about the ding-dang post office. Because, you see, the Democrats have made up this entire story that President Trump is trying to eliminate the post office or cripple the post office so you can't vote. And that, as they say, is a whopper. Now, in today's show notes, I won't get to everything here. But in today's show notes, I have an article from the American Institute for Economic Research. That's AIER.org. And it's about when mail slowdowns actually started. And they weren't, it didn't start last year. It didn't start the year before. It didn't start when Trump became focused on trying to cut to staunch the flow of bleeding at the post office. It actually started about 50 years ago. And you need to read this article. I don't think I can get to all of it. I have 5 minutes left here, so I don't think I can get to all of it. But you need to know that the Postal Service over the years has been slowing down its performance with step after step after step. At one time, they were supposed to be able to deliver a letter overnight. And now the standard is, and this is not nationwide. This is not coast to coast. Keep this in mind. This is in the same city. Now it's 5 days. And I've fussed about this in the past before. It just amazes me that I could drop something in the mail to somebody who lives literally 5 miles from me, and it might take 3 days to get there. I could walk it to them faster. And that's how things are happening. And the reason this is happening, the reason things are slowing down, is because the Postal Service has been changing their standards in order to be able to brag that they're ahead of the curve in performance. They're lowering the bar to make themselves look better. And they've been doing it for 50 years, bit by bit by bit, so that now they can say, well, we're meeting all of our requirements. And yet they're still losing $2.5 billion a quarter. Absolutely insane. Now, we could solve, in the United States today, we could solve that particular problem by repealing just a couple of small things and allowing private businesses like FedEx and UPS to deliver small items like letters that aren't of an urgent nature. Now, the Postal Service has a lock on that. They have a monopoly on certain kinds of correspondence. They legally do. And you have to pay $15, $20, $25 to deliver essentially the same thing using another service, and it has to be classified as an overnight delivery or something like that, an urgent delivery. You remember the FedEx motto, when it absolutely, positively has to be there overnight. FedEx. Remember the old motto? Well, that was the whole urgency thing. And that's how they could get around delivering documents, because it's vital. Otherwise, it's under the purview of the Postal Service. It has to be. So if it's urgent, you send it via FedEx and now by UPS. So we could very, very, very easily fix the problem by ending the postal monopoly. If we did that, we could spur the same explosion of options for delivering letters that Uber and Lyft created for transportation. So ask yourself and ask your friends, when was the last time you called a taxi service now that Uber and Lyft are around? Which is why in California, the cab unions, the taxi unions, have pulled the politicians in and got them to almost completely ban Uber and Lyft services, making it so difficult for them to comply with regulation that they're just about to completely pull out of California. And that's because the taxi people, the unions behind taxi drivers, own enough politicians that they can get legislation passed to eliminate their competition. But if you end the Postal Service monopoly on delivering letters, then you could drop a letter off at UPS or FedEx, and it'll be in somebody's hands in a couple of days for just a couple of dollars, instead of having to pay $20 to $25. You need to read the article. It's very enlightening. And it tells the story about how the Postal Service has done this to itself. Instead of actually growing and expanding and improving, they've just lowered the bar. And I have to lower the boom on this edition of the Daily Perspective Podcast. That's it for today. God bless you. Have a good one. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Bye-bye.
Oh, we're done.